Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Holly Kite. Holly is a journalist and author, specialising in the forgotten stories and neglected aspects of women's lives. Roaring Girls, The Forgotten Feminists of British History, is her first book. Hi, Holly. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're here to discuss your book, Roaring Girls, which comes out in paperback this month and was published in hardback a little while ago. It tells the story of 9 women who you call the Forgotten Feminists of British History. And their lives mostly took place before any coherent or codified feminist movement began to take shape with suffrage or things later in the 19th century. Could you speak a bit more about the parameters of your book and its focus?
Yeah, so I very deliberately chose women who lived before the first wave of feminism mobilised in the sort of mid to late 19th century, because I wanted to know how women negotiated the world before that happened. I was very interested to know how women, just who didn't fit into the normal mold of what a woman was supposed to be, which was very prescribed, you know, she was supposed to be morally and sexually pure, she was supposed to be obedient, she was supposed to be quiet. And I just thought, well, there must have been so many women who didn't fit that mold at all. And so how did those women negotiate the world? How did they find the loopholes? How did they express themselves before feminism had come along and sort of validated their feelings and sort of made it a much more widespread focus for people to think about? And so that's why I deliberately chose sort of pre-feminist women. And I started it when I did in around the sort of Jacobean era with this woman, Mary Frith, who the book is named after. She was the original Roaring Girl. And I started it with her because she just seemed to encapsulate everything I was looking for, everything I was trying to explain and explore about these women. So she was a, in a nutshell, she was a cross-dressing, pipe-smoking, sword-wielding, foul-mouthed thief in Jacobean London. And she became a kind of folk heroine. People sort of loved to hate her. She became famous. She became a sort of entertainer who would do sort of skits in the street. She got in loads of trouble. She got arrested numerous times for thieving, but also for cross-dressing. And she became so famous that a play was written about her in 1611 called The Roaring Girl by Thomas Dekker and Thomas Middleton, who were, you know, prolific playwrights, contemporaries of Shakespeare. And they not only sort of base this character, Moll Cutpurse, on Mary Frith, but they also just make her the heroine of the play. So even though she's this kind of controversial sort of hellraiser figure, she's their heroine. She's the sort of the person who brings the lovers together and resolves all the chaos in the play. And so there's obviously a real affection for her as well as the fact that she kind of stirs things up and makes people uncomfortable. So she is the original Roaring Girl, which sort of dictionary definition of it is a noisy, bawdy or riotous woman or girl, especially one who takes on a masculine role. And that's exactly what Mary Frith was. And that seemed to encapsulate to me what all of these women that I've chosen seem to embody in some way or other.
Yeah, and it's so brilliant. Reading it, you fall in love with Mary Frith, but she was quite a character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's one of those people who you'd kind of love to meet. You'd love to spend a bit of time with her, but she would steal your wallet. So you'd have to be pretty careful.
Yeah. She might use it to buy you a drink. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. She would. You'd have a laugh. You'd have a laugh with her. That's for sure.
So from Mary Frith to Caroline Norton, the women you mention and discuss are from all sections of society. So you've got a slave, a duchess, soldier, actress. How, when you were looking, so it's broadly about a 300-year period of history, how did you choose who to cover?
Oh, it was so difficult. I started off with a very long list and had to really whittle it down. It was quite a brutal process. But basically my criteria, I sort of wanted, again, very deliberately, I didn't want women who were already sort of household names, already famous. So as much as I love, you know, Elizabeth I and Jane Austen, they were too well known. And I just thought, I don't necessarily want to look at women who were, you know, queens, or who had written a classic novel, or had, you know, invented computer coding, or I didn't necessarily want women who had sort of done something pretty world-changing in that way. I was very interested in more sort of ordinary women, and how they just dealt with the struggles of everyday life. And some of them are more ordinary than others. Like you say, I have a duchess in there, and that's, you know, that's extremely privileged. But I also have a slave in Mary Prince. And so, and we sort of have everyone in between that. So it was much more interesting to me to just see how ordinary women dealt with the issues that came up day to day. And obviously the fact that they've even survived in the historical record means that these women were extraordinary in lots of ways rather than ordinary. If you were particularly ordinary and you completely played by the rules, you didn't usually make much of a mark in the historical record if you were a woman. And these women did, they did leave a mark, so that they were extraordinary and ordinary at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking about their extraordinariness, there's something to be said with how they leave a mark in the historical record. You came up against really quite fuzzy or difficult or contradictory historical records all the time.
Yes. So
you already mentioned the play that's written about Mary Frith, but if you look at Hannah Snell or some of the records about Margaret Cavendish, things don't really add up, do they? How did you deal with that murky world of conflicting biographies?
It's incredibly difficult, but it's also part of the fun of writing about history, because there are so many gaps. You're kind of having to play detective, which is what's so fun about it. And it's a very interesting point, especially when you're writing about eight women, as I was. You've got eight separate sets of sources, and they range hugely in terms of their fullness and their reliability. So you have someone like Anne Lister, who's written a 5 million word diary, which is so detailed and so personal that it's the dream source, in the sense that it's as close as you can get to being in her head. And you've almost got too much material. I mean, the full extent of her diaries haven't even been transcribed yet because they're so huge. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have got people like Hannah Snell and Mary Frith, where the sources are very contradictory and very patchy. And you have sort of swathes like 20 odd years where you don't know anything about what they were doing. And you have to try and fill in those gaps. And you just have to try and make educated guesses. And you have to accept that you might never know the exact answer. And that can be really frustrating. But it does also allow a bit of imagination to take hold, and you can sort of wonder, okay, well, if she's in this situation and we know this about her personality, what do we think might have happened in this situation, or what she might have been doing, or where it might have taken her? So it's very, very difficult, and you always have to, with historical sources, you're always having to think, how is this being mediated through the centuries? You know, Mary Prince is an interesting example, because she was the first Black woman in Britain to publish her life story as a slave, but she was illiterate. So she had to tell her story through a mediator who wrote her story down for her. So that brings up all sorts of issues about whether her words were changed. And the people who wrote her story down insisted that they wrote everything down exactly as she said it, but we don't know that. And you have to sort of analyze it and figure out how accurate it might be and how inaccurate it might be. And it's an absolute minefield.
Yeah, and makes me think of Marjorie Kemp. I mean, I know it's a couple of centuries earlier, but that same sense that you've got a man transcribing a woman's words, and that's the historical record that we end up with.
Exactly. Yeah, there's always a question of mediation, and has it been, not tainted, that's probably the wrong word, but, you know, are there other issues at play here? And the other voices that come in that might be filtering it in some way, they always have something to reveal as well about the time that you're looking at and the way that the women were viewed and treated. You know, the fact that any hint of Mary Prince's sexual life, for example, seems to have been expunged from her narrative, tells you a lot about the attitudes of that time towards women, particularly towards Black women, about wanting her to seem sort of asexual. So there could be no, you know, they're trying to portray her story to aid the abolition cause, they want it to be as powerful and as effective as possible. So they take out anything that might upset the public, basically.
Yeah, so she become purer than she possibly could have been, in a sense. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, well, I suppose actually, no, her story was purified as well, but Hannah Stell, and then her story was made into a kind of public sensation. I mean, a PR man took it on, but same time.
Absolutely. It was, yeah, so this is a woman who started off by abiding by the rules. This is in the mid-18th century. She got married, she had a child, and her husband left her, her baby died, and she just decided to put on her brother-in-law's suit and went off to join the army, and fought as a man and came back and became a huge celebrity. So as you say, a publisher obviously rushed to buy her story, wrote her biography, again, a story being mediated by a man. We don't know exactly how much of it has directly come from her. We don't know exactly how accurate it was. And she becomes a huge celebrity with her own stage show. And it's, again, we don't know. I mean, it's one of those interesting things where she was obviously a huge sensation, but not for that long. It didn't last. The success didn't last for very long. And there seems to have been a sort of caveat whereby, as if she took the cross-dressing thing too far, then people turned against her. If she went back to wearing a dress afterwards, then people could accept it and could enjoy it as entertainment. So there's all sorts of interesting issues going on there. Yeah,
so I really wanted to talk about that. So with Mary Frith, Charlotte Chuck, and Hannah Snell, you mentioned a vogue for cross-dressing that spread across Europe in early modern history, particularly in the UK. So a bit more about that. What freedom did it provide? I mean, both physically from the constraints of corsets and dresses, but also mentally, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I was just delighted to discover that this existed, that this was a trend. And it's exactly that. It's partly just a physical thing. You know, women's fashion has always been very restrictive, you know, tight corsets and cumbersome petticoats. You know, you can't do anything practical in that. And so I think a lot of it was partly to do with that, women just finding it annoying, having to be sort of bound in this way. But it is much more symbolic than that. It is obviously a sort of form of civil disobedience, I think. It's a way of kicking against the rules of society, kicking against what a woman is supposed to be. It's very subversive. It has all sorts of sexual connotations. Mary Frith is, you know, basically they're all accused of being a whore because of it, because it's seen as, they're sort of appropriating masculinity, which is just totally unacceptable, because women aren't allowed to act like men. They're not allowed to be sexually provocative like men. They're not allowed to sort of own their sexuality in that way. But it also has more practical considerations. Charlotte Chuck was an 18th century actress. She started off cross-dressing on the stage in what are called breeches parts, which are basically female characters in a play who dress up for a part of the plot as a boy. So Viola in Twelfth Night is a breeches part. And Charlotte Chuck specialised in these parts. She loved them. And then she started doing travesty parts, which is when a male character is played by a woman. So she also played Roderigo in Othello, for example. And she obviously loved cross-dressing so much that she then started doing it offstage as well, and just lived as a man for about 5 years, called Charles Brown. And that had a real... It was obviously, I think, an expression of her sexuality and her personality, but it was also quite practical in that she wasn't getting any work as an actor. She'd been disowned by her father. And so she was really struggling to survive. And she, as a man, was able to get work that she would not have been able to get as a woman. And so it was a survival method. And she was also hiding from debtors and all sorts of stuff. So there are numerous, numerous reasons why women would do it. And they wouldn't always be honest in their biographies and their accounts. They weren't always honest about why they were doing it, because they just couldn't say it. They couldn't, if it was an expression of their sexuality, they couldn't say that, because they didn't have the language to talk about it. We didn't at that point sort of categorize human sexuality and sexual identity in that way. So they wouldn't have been able to sort of say, well, yes, it's because I'm attracted to women, or because I would rather be a man. You know, they weren't able to sort of say that. That was too difficult to say. So they sort of came up with other reasons why they might have done it. Like, for example, the sort of the classic excuse, if that's the word, that women who ran off to war or to sea would always give is that they were chasing after a lover or a husband who'd gone missing and they were trying to track him down. So, you know, we can believe that if we want, but I'm not sure that was usually the reason.
It's a brilliant excuse because it puts it back in the terms of, you know, heterosexual wronged woman looking for a man again.
Exactly. And that was acceptable to society, whereas saying that you just loved dressing up in men's clothes was not acceptable. So you had to come up with this other reason to make it palatable to people. Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by the idea of the breeches part being both a kind of symbol of, in a way, female sexual liberation, or just female liberation, but also it was erotic titillation for the men who go to watch the women on stage. There's the beginning of the 1667 adaptation of The Tempest. Have you read where they say, one of our women to present a boy, and that's a transformation, you will say, exceeding all the magic in the play? So at the end of the prologue, they say, if you fancy seeing more of the woman, you can find her in her bed.
Well, you see, this is exactly it. So basically, being an actress was quite a sort of tightrope that you had to walk, because there were real sexual connotations to it. The idea of sort of parading yourself on stage, and obviously, you know, women weren't even allowed on the stage until the Restoration in 1660. So, you know, this was a new thing, and it was considered morally a bit dubious and a bit loose, because you were putting yourself out there for money, for other people's entertainment and titillation. And exactly that, the breeches parts were an excuse to see a bit of leg. You know, women were usually trussed up in these huge dresses. Suddenly they were in breeches and they got to see a shapely leg, and it was thoroughly exciting. And it was the whole frisson of the sort of gender twist and seeing women behave in an outrageous way that they wouldn't normally be allowed to behave in off stage. And that was incredibly exciting for the audience. But obviously these actresses were not supposed to carry that into real life, which is why Charlotte Charke was so daring and so extraordinary, because she took that subversive thing that she was doing on stage and she did it in real life as well.
Yeah, and in Hannah Snell's case, it's not cross-dressing on the stage at all, but it just blows my mind that she was able to continue pretending she was a man in close quarters with all those men on a ship.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, yes, exactly. She was on a ship for God knows how long with men, and you just think, well, how on earth did she get away with it? And she's not the only one. There are numerous historical cases of women going to war and not being found out, or supposedly, as we, you know, we're told that they weren't found out until they sort of decide to disclose it. And that does seem extraordinary to us. And so there's sort of various things that are going on there. It's either that the men around them did realize and just thought, doesn't matter, we'll just go along with it, it's fine. Which, you know, is possible. It seems extraordinary that they might be fine with it, but maybe they were. Or it's just a case that they were very good actresses and they were just able to play that part. And if they felt incredibly masculine in their persona anyway, it probably didn't even feel like much of a masquerade to them. But also there are interesting sort of issues about being on ship. You know, you were very rarely, you know, naked. There was no sanitation or anything like that. You weren't, you know, going in and out of the shower every 5 minutes. You know, everyone was wearing the same clothes for months on end. So it wasn't sort of, you weren't as exposed actually as you would sort of think you would be. And they just found ways of avoiding it. So Hannah Snell deliberately kind of flirted with women to seem as masculine as she could. She had, you know, contraptions so that she could wee standing up. You know, they had ingenious ways of doing it. And I think they always sort of tried to portray themselves as a sort of androgynous prepubescent boy. That was the kind of easiest way to get away with it. So they obviously weren't going to come across as a sort of gruff bearded guy, but as a sort of smooth-faced youth, they could get away with that. So, you know, yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I wanted to talk a bit about Mary Prince, because her life is quite different to the rest of the women that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, so she obviously was a slave. She was born in Bermuda, ended up living in Antigua, and she is different in the sense that everything was very much forced on her. The story that we have and the reason why she's so extraordinary is she wouldn't have chosen it, to put it that way. She was brought to London in 1828 with her owner, And she was then, when she got to England, in a really strange loophole whereby she was technically free. You couldn't technically, the law had established that you couldn't technically be a slave on English soil. And so she got to this country and she was like, technically, legally, I'm a free woman. But she was in a horrendous catch-22, whereby if she went home to her family and her husband in Antigua, she would be a slave again. So she basically couldn't win. But she did an incredibly brave thing and decided to walk away from her owner and try and be free. He refused to grant her manumission because he was not a pleasant man, unsurprisingly. And so she went to the Anti-Slavery Society. And as I mentioned before, she told her story to this man, Thomas Pringle, who was an abolitionist and wanted to kind of do something to help the cause. And so she tells her story, and as all slave narratives are, it's a horrific story of torture and abuse and dehumanization, and it's horrendous. But her pamphlet, her story, became a real bestseller, and it coincided, this was sort of 1831, slavery ended in 1833, so it really coincided with when the movement was sort of galvanizing, and it had quite an effect because it was so horrific. It really showed, and it wasn't the only slave narrative out there, but it was the first female slave narrative to come out in this country, and it really did have an effect. So she's come down to us as an important historical figure, not so much because she wanted to live wildly or buck the trends and all the rest of it. She just wanted freedom. She just wanted the absolute basics of freedom. She was a victim of circumstance, essentially. So yeah, she's a very different case.
Yeah, and very different again, and in no ways had in any way such a difficult life. But Mary Astell also wasn't big on the daring do. She published a tract, A Serious Proposal to the Ladies, which was about female education and living away from the rest of society in an ideal school. Yeah,
she was very conservative in that sense. She's the most non-roaring girl of my roaring girls, in the sense that she would never have cross-dressed or done anything outrageous at all. She was deeply religious. She was very ascetic. She was very against sort of worldly pleasures and all these kinds of things, but she had an incredible intellect, and she is probably, out of all of the women in the book, the one that we would most closely identify with a modern feminist, because she really fiercely believed in women's intellectual equality with men. And she was writing in the late 1600s, there were not many people who would have agreed with her that women were men's intellectual equal, but she absolutely takes it as a given. And she writes the first really sort of intellectually rigorous, rational argument for why women deserve complete equality with men and why they absolutely have to be educated. And also why she writes another pamphlet later on about marriage, about why women should value themselves more highly than sort of thinking that their only ambition in life should be to get married. So these are amazing ideas that still hold a lot of weight today.
Yeah, I think she's absolutely brilliant. I love her, completely adore her. So we've talked a bit, I think, throughout the book, there is a sense that perhaps what these women are doing, in a sense, is probably, maybe, we don't really know, tied to a different sexuality. But Anne Lister is maybe the first modern lesbian, I think you call her. Could you speak a bit more about her sexuality?
Yes. I mean, I think a lot of people will now know who she is because of Gentleman Jack, the BBC drama, which is coming back for series two very soon. But I came across her in 2016 when she wasn't really sort of being talked about very much. And she was the reason I wrote the book in the first place, because I was reading a biography of Charlotte Bronte, who lived very near to Anne Lister. And I just came across this one paragraph that just said, down the road in the 1830s, an heiress named Anne Lister was living with her lover, Anne Walker, at Shibden Hall. And I was just, it completely stopped me in my tracks. And I was just like, hang on. I mean, I love Charlotte Bronte, but who is this? This is fascinating. It felt to me like this was a type of women's history that really wasn't being talked about enough, wasn't in the sort of mainstream. And I just thought, well, I need to know everything about this woman. So obviously I Googled her, discovered that she'd written this 5 million word diary and that some of it was in written in code of her own devising so that she could write about her lesbian experiences. And it's the most phenomenal document. It's such an important document in the sort of history of women's sexuality because there's just nothing else like it. It's like a firsthand, completely honest account of women's lesbian sexuality, and it's just completely groundbreaking. And what's fascinating about it is actually how within her society there's a lot of it going on. Like, we kind of think that, you know, there wouldn't be that many women who would sort of dare to indulge that part of their sexuality, but actually there were loads of women who were entirely happy to to experiment and try it. Some of them, like her long-term lover Marianne Lawton, ended up marrying men because it was too difficult to sort of avoid that. If they wanted the sort of security and the money and the house and all the rest of it, they kind of had to do that. But like Mariana, they carried on seeing their lesbian lovers on the side kind of thing. So it's a fascinating window into how lesbian women operated and how they got around things. And actually they could get around it quite relatively easily because they could, there was this concept of romantic friendship, which was a sort of very intense female friendship that was regarded as a beautiful and noble thing. And most people didn't even suspect that there might be a sort of sexual element to it. And, you know, they could just come across as friends and just be having sex that nobody, you know, nobody noticed or realized that what they were doing behind closed doors. So it's a really, really fascinating insight. And Anne List is particularly interesting because she was so, the reason why I think she's referred to as the first modern lesbian is because obviously this is a time before sort of sexual identity and categorization, all that kind of stuff. The word lesbian didn't exist. She wouldn't have been able to say, I am a lesbian. But from her writing, you can tell that she understands that it is part of her being. It's part of her identity as a person. She's not, there's no angst about it. She's not sort of confused about it. She's, you know, she just accepts that it's part of who she is. She loves women. Women love her. It's as simple as that. So there's no sort of torture involved in it, which is why she feels so modern to us. You know, there's, it's just part of who she is. It's great.
So lovely. So you end the book with a sense that things have come a long way, and your book ends just before a kind of, you know, the beginning nascent suffrage movement and everything. International Women's Day was just this week. But things maybe haven't changed as much as they should have done, do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, this is why we need so many waves of feminism, because every time we sort of achieve something new, we realise actually that there's more that we need to do. The goalposts are always moving. Like, the women in my book are pre-feminism, so they are absolutely fighting for the fundamental basics, you know, the basics of being able to have an education, the basics of being able to wear what you want to wear, to have a job, to have legal visibility, to be able to earn your own money. These are the sorts of absolute basic things that they are trying to fight for. And obviously since then we've made huge, huge strides, but we're still living with so many inequalities. You know, there's always the people who say, oh, feminism's gone too far. Well, when you look at the statistics, when you realize that, you know, we've still got a gender pay gap, we've still got two women a week being killed by their partners, we've still got historically low conviction rates for rape and things like that. You know, we've still got, most of the people in power are still men. You know, there are still so many things that we need to push for. And it seems to me that one of the important things about knowing about women like my Roaring Girls is that you need to understand where all of that has come from in order to understand why we're still living with these things. You have to understand the thousands of years of oppression that has gone into creating this situation. So, yeah, we've come a long way, but there is so much more to do.
Completely agree. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.